Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The Double X Gab Fest is sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/XX.
Welcome to the Double X Gab Fest for Thursday, May 16th, the Healed by Love edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, editor of Double X. I am joined in the DC studio by Dan Coyce, senior editor of Slate. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how are you?
Good. And New Republic writer Noreen Malone. Hi, Noreen.
Hey.
So our three topics today. First, rape jokes. Are they okay or are they not okay? Second is the rehabilitation of certain cads, particularly political cads, meaning Mark Sanford and Anthony Weiner, who gets a second chance and who doesn't, and why. And third, we'll talk about the new biology of loneliness with Judith Shulevitz, who's the author of a cover story in the New Republic about this subject. So let's start with rape jokes. Anybody have a rape joke? I didn't know any rape jokes. I don't. Like, mostly it involves, like, you go to a club and then the comedian says, so I raped this woman, and then everyone laughs because of the word rape. But anyway, the way this started is that a couple of weeks ago, The Onion ran a short item about Chris Brown and Rihanna that made many feminists and people irate. And I'm going to read you a short excerpt from that item, which was very short. Okay, here it goes. After revealing yesterday that he had recently split up with longtime girlfriend Rihanna, a heartbroken Chris Brown tearfully told reporters that he always thought the 25-year-old singer was going to be the woman he beat to death one day. Despite all the ups and downs, I was so sure Rihanna was the one I'd take by the throat one day and fatally assault. And even towards the end, I continued to hold out hope that we'd be together until the day she died at my hands from blunt force trauma. God, it's really like a different experience to read it out loud than it is to just read it on the page. Anyway, this led to a bigger discussion, which had already begun, about whether rape jokes were off limits, whether certain male comedians were making too many rape jokes, and then, even more broadly, whether comedy remains a place that's totally hostile to women. So I came out and wrote a post saying I thought the Onion piece was perfectly fine. In fact, I thought it was better than fine because it was obvious to me that the guy who wrote it was horrified by domestic violence and because it was really well executed.
Or the woman who wrote it.
Or the woman who wrote it. That's true. I don't know who wrote it. Dan, you said you only partially agreed with
me. No, I said I agreed with almost everything in your piece.
Okay. That was a tease to say something like that because it was on Twitter and then I said what? Like a lot of people said they disagreed. They tweeted at me, you know, fuck you, I disagree, whatever. But I got nobody like gave me an argument. And so, in fact, I had to figure out an argument for myself and have moved in my position slightly, which I'll get to soon. But Dan, tell me, you know, what did you agree with and what didn't you agree with?
I also agree that the piece is good and that I really liked it a lot, the Onion piece. I sort of disagree with you a little bit on the issue of funniness in sort of two directions. One is that there are things about that Chris Brown Rihanna piece that is funny, but it is also a piece that The Onion does often, which I think is not actually meant to be funny, like quote-unquote funny. It's not meant to be funny in a traditional way. I think it's just meant to be angry. I think it's meant to be super pissed off at Chris Brown and to attempt to fill readers with as much rage and contempt for Chris Brown as the writer him or herself feels.
If you did that and that showed very evidently, the piece wouldn't work. Wouldn't it just fall flat? I mean, wouldn't you need to inject some absurdness into it?
Like, sure.
You know, the sort of mimicking of the words blunt force trauma, for example.
Sure. I mean, it uses the rhetorical devices of humor and by virtue of being part of The Onion, it is a satirical piece, but I don't think the goal of it is to make people laugh. And in that way, it's very different from the quote unquote rape jokes that we're talking about that comedians tell, and that the joke is not, I raped this chick last week. The joke, if there is one, is on the attacker, and the contempt of the piece is directed at the attacker. I was arguing about this on Twitter last week with a bunch of people, and the line that I kept coming back to is this line that Ian Frazier once used to write about Veronica Gang, who was a great satirist who wrote for The New Yorker and who was his editor at The New Yorker for many years. And he wrote about her that sometimes her writing was the purest satire, in the sense that its ultimate object, and in the sense that it would be most satisfied if its object dropped dead.
I just want to say that at this moment in time, I think The Onion, taken as a whole, is like my favorite op-ed columnist. They have a wonderful moral core, and thanks I wouldn't call this piece funny. I would call it deeply, cuttingly sarcastic. But they can sort of they don't have the earnestness that a lot of writers who have that deep moral core often display. And it makes it more trenchant. Like, and they also are sort of, they've taken this turn for the radically feminist that I kind of love. I mean, I would file that under this, but it also the piece, or there are two pieces that made me think that. One was after those three young women were found in Cleveland. The Onion wrote a fake op-ed from those girls saying, aren't men wonderful? You know, aren't male instincts just the best? That's the only thing we know.
So what? Man, I thought that one was insane.
Like, that was way out on a limb. But I mean, that was not my kind of feminism. That was like, God, like men are, biologically, programmed to be rapists, which I don't, agree with. But they were like really taking a strong feminist stance on that one. And no one got that angry about that one. And I'm just curious what's different about the Rihanna Chris Brown thing. And then, if we look back to the Oscars controversy, they sent a tweet saying that the adorable little girl in Beast of the Southern Wired.
Come on, pronounce her name.
I cannot pronounce her name. Oh my God. Okay, thank you. Saying that she was a C word. And they retracted that. A lot of the critics have focused on the fact that those two, that woman and that girl, are black. And I'm curious if you guys think that that has anything to do with the reaction.
Given what Dan just said, I am more baffled by the reaction, not less baffled by the reaction. Huh. And also given what you said, because you're both kind of taking it for granted that The Onion was furious about domestic violence, that The Onion has a sort of strong and maybe even radical feminist streak. And yet the reaction to this was rape jokes are off limits. Like, this isn't funny. It's not absurd. It's not sarcastic. Basically, they're not allowed to do this.
Right. Well, the reaction to it was that people, many, many people, reasonable people with whom I often agree about a lot of stuff, read the piece as specifically being cruel to Rihanna, as her being the object or the butt of the joke. Which, to me, it's impossible to read it that way.
Right.
But it obviously isn't impossible because people totally did. And
right.
Is it just that this specific case and the pictures that we've seen of Rihanna make it too hard, in the same way that it would be too hard if it was, a piece about your sister or your mom or something like that? Or is it because she's a woman of color and people are quick to connect dots and make an assumption about an editorial stance at a paper? I don't know.
Or is it because Rihanna writes music saying, fuck you, stay out of my relationship? And so maybe she, maybe she deserves a little poking at in this situation too. Like, she has often defied people's judgment about her decisions to stay in a relationship with Chris Brown. So, I'm not saying she's exactly fair game, but it wouldn't, it's not the same as a pure, it's not the same as the three women in Cleveland, for example.
Was the other Onion piece you're going to mention the 15-year-old girl blossoms into a beautiful object?
It sure was.
Yeah.
It's a really funny piece. That one was funny.
Yeah, that is funny, but it's also angry. And that also is like the most feminist thing that I have probably read in 3 years.
I did not. I had trouble understanding. I feel very – I did not exactly get that. I actually even tried it out on my daughter. I was I kind of need the joke explained to me,
wait,
I'm sorry to say.
Can
I'm
we
really
read
sorry.
It?
Okay. Calling the transformation both delightful and stunning, friends and family members confirmed Tuesday that 17-year-old Ashley Parker was blossoming into an absolutely gorgeous object. According to Parker's relatives, in the span of 14 months, the high school junior underwent a staggering metamorphosis from a young girl with thoughts, feelings, and aspirations into a truly stunning commodity.
So what did you need explained to you?
No, you're right. Actually, when I read it the second time, I think I must have been high when I read it the first time. It's like completely obvious.
So let's talk then about the sort of the debate that this grew into, which is not about domestic violence specifically or women of color specifically, but went along sidewise along with a couple of pieces that Sadie Doyle wrote about a comedian whose show she went to named Sam Morril. And that show was heavily dependent on rape jokes of the, it seems from what has been recounted to us in these pieces, that seemed to be of the "I raped this lady last night, it was hilarious" variety. I mean, I'm sure they were slightly better than that. But so Sadie wrote a piece in which she basically just posted the long email she wrote to Sam Morril trying to engage him in these issues. And then after like a week and a half, when he didn't write back, she just posted the email. And then a couple days later, he did respond with a long, angry Facebook post responding to Sadie Doyle. And so that led to this greater discussion, which comes up every once in a while. It came up last summer with Daniel Tosh. Which is, why are comedians, male comedians, so dependent on rape jokes, it seems? Are they ever okay? What if someone you really love who sort of seems like a feminist like Louis C.K. does it? Then is it okay? What if the joke is really, really good? Then is it okay? Or should we just assume that unless you're actually Louis C.K., you should probably find something else to joke about?
So I just saw Sarah Silverman live. Now, this isn't the same because there's an element of violence in the rape joke. But she gets one over on men with a series of blowjob jokes that she does, which are, again, designed to totally poke fun at men. She pretends to be the kind of woman who, like, gets an orgasm from a blowjob. I can't remember exactly the joke. But these jokes that are sort of purely pushing the edge are kind of tricky for me. I never quite find them funny. Like, the pure shock value, you just say the word "I raped a woman" or you just say the word "blowjob." I don't know. They don't exactly work for me. They seem unsophisticated as a form of joking. It's just like the pushing of the edge is a little too obvious.
And I think, you know, that's maybe what attracts comedians to them, is that it's sort of the final frontier, right? And so it seems crazy that all of these straight white male comedians would be making rape jokes. That's sort of the main transgression left to them in some ways.
Right.
And I'm kind of with you. I think like boundary pushing needs to be in the service of something. In the defense that he wrote, Morril said that Sadie Doyle cut off his joke, and that at the end of his joke, he was sort of saying that his joke was actually about race. And his joke was like a meta joke.
I was only about raping black women. It wasn't, you know.
Well, right. So the joke is, you know, he says something to the effect of, "I slept with a black woman once. She was saying the N-word the whole time." And the audience, I guess, you know, sort of gasps. And he says, "She was saying no." And then he's like, "That's a rape joke." He defends himself by saying, "Oh, I was playing with the racism of the audience. They all thought I was going to say the N-word. And in fact, I was making a rape joke." And I don't know if I think that's high art or...
I mean, he was playing with... He's not being quite honest there. He was playing with, like, where the audience's limits were and just general PC-ness. Like,
yes.
I'm going to catch you on one thing,
mm-hmm.
but then I'm going to turn it into a different PC thing. And let's see which one is worse. And let you examine yourself if you, say, feel relief when you think I was going to make a racist joke. But then I end up making a rape joke. And so you feel relief for 1 second that I didn't make the racist joke. But then you're sort of incensed that I made the rape joke. I mean, it's kind of an interesting, you know, a lot of comedy, and particularly particularly shock comedy like that is about having us examine our own reactions and kind of having unexpected reactions to the thing that the person is saying and sort of wondering why we had those reactions. So in that sense, like, the joke works.
Right.
And it also shows that he has a sort of consciousness of the lines that we'll accept and we won't accept. But I do have to say, like, listening to Sadie Doyle's description of the show and I Wish I'd Been There, it did sound sort of tediously rape-focused. Like, I don't know how many male comedians do this, but it did sound like, how many rape jokes are you really going to make in one half hour?
I agree. And I do think that there is something to be said for making the audience examine their own, you know, prejudices and whatever. But, you know, a lot of the women who have written about this have said that – have pointed out, you know, somewhat obviously but very correctly, that almost every audience will have at least one person in it who has been raped. And I think maybe that's what's a little bit different about a rape joke. Like, if you're making a joke about, you know, something like race, let's say, like, you can see who in your audience probably is not of the same race as you. But you can't tell by looking at someone if they've been raped, for instance. And I think that adds a little bit – it just makes it a little harder to – tread on that ground, maybe.
Yeah, but why? That's not the comedian's job, is like to avoid offending people.
No,
like,
I know. I've just been trying to, because, okay, my knee-jerk reaction is that, like, anything can be funny if it's actually funny, like if it's actually well deployed. And uh-huh. I've been trying to think through the counter arguments to that. And I think that is one thing that gives me pause, I guess.
So here's the thing that moved me a little bit is Molly is – I don't know if you pronounce her name Kneffel or Kneffel, but she wrote a piece in Salon called The Rape Joke Double Standard, which I found quite convincing, because her point was that these same comedians making rape jokes have all sorts of things that they will expressly say is off limits. Like, they'll, you know, tweet or say something about one particular tragedy in this very earnest way. So in a way, if a comedian shows his hand that way and says, oh, this thing is to be taken seriously, like the Boston bombing or something, you know, a period of time has to pass before I'm going to make jokes about this, then that shows that there are some things that are off limits. And so then it becomes legitimate for women who are offended by rape jokes to come in and say, well, put that in your off limits box. Like, why is only rape not off limits, but all these other things are off limits?
Yeah. And I also think there's something important about point of view in the rape joke. So there's Louis C.K. told a rape joke that was sort of universally heralded as a feminist rape joke, and I actually think it had a lot in common with the two onion jokes. God, I am like repeating all these jokes and making them unfunny and screwing them up.
But we're not professional comedians; it's fine.
So Dan, help me out here. So his line was basically –
I can't remember which one
right.
You're doing.
Okay, so I think this is the one that everyone sort of loved. He said, you know, it's very scary to be a woman.
Oh, yeah, that one.
You step
yeah.
outside your apartment, basically, and you're at risk. I mean, that was not –
that wasn't like a rape joke, but he was basically saying, like, the man is the line. He's saying, like, why would a woman want to go on a date with a man?
Yes.
Like, he has a very strong, like, men are beasts theme that runs through his comedy. So it was like the lion, you know, is going on a date with the bunny, basically.
Right. Like, yeah. Imagine if you had to go out on – if you were a dude and everyone you went on a date with was a lion. And a lot of times you get mauled or killed, but this time maybe it's a,
yeah.
a nice lion.
Yeah. You'd be like, oh, maybe this lion will be a nice lion. Right. Exactly. So I mean, maybe that's the more sophisticated thing to do, is to walk all sides of that relationship.
Right. I mean, I feel like if you can tell a rape joke while also remaining a human being. Like,
right.
The problem with Sam Morril is that, or at least with that specific joke, is I don't give a shit what Sam Morril says on his Facebook page. That was not actually his goal for the joke. His goal for the joke was not to get his audience to think about their assumptions about race and gender. His goal for that joke was to get the shock value laughter of two forbidden things instead of just one forbidden thing
right.
in one joke.
Right.
That was his goal. And he got it, and that's great. But then to write this Facebook post about, oh, actually, I'm like undermining the patriarchy is like absurd.
Right.
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 And I think there's a way in which, like, the Louis C.K. joke and the onion jokes feel like they're on, like, Team Woman, and
right.
the Sam Morril joke just doesn't.
Well, Louis C.K. said something so interesting in his interview with Jon Stewart, when Jon Stewart asked him, because he had defended Tosh when Tosh made his rape joke, and so he went on to talk to Jon Stewart about it, and he said, you know, so what have you learned? All these people have written to you, and he said, oh, I learned a lot. You know, these women educated me about what rape is like and what their experience is like, and I'm, you know, I have more layers as a human being because of that, but I'm still going to tell a rape joke. You know, so it's like it's the way in which he manages to be both a human being and still tell a rape joke.
Here's the other thing I disagreed with you about.
Okay, go ahead.
The Covenant Wallace tweet was funny.
It was?
Yeah.
Bold stance. Huh. Bold stance.
Right. But unfortunately, we don't have time to explore that right now, because we have to move on to our next topic.
No. But I actually have one last point I want to make, and then we'll move on to our next topic. This broader conversation about whether comedy is hostile to women. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I just want to say I just feel like we're in this opposite moment where women are becoming kind of normalized in comedy. I mean, they're just all different kinds. There's like nice, clean Mindy Kaling. There's like Amy Schumer. There's Sarah Silverman. I just feel like that world is opening up. Am I wrong about that? I mean, maybe it's still really hostile to women in some corners.
I think the average comedy club in like Kansas City is still extremely hostile to women.
Because the culture of comedy is a
right.
dude culture.
And because if you're a female comic, when you go on stage in like a night of 10 comics, it will definitely only be you. And they'll be like, all right, here's our lady for the night. Blah, blah, blah. And
right.
You're the representative of the entire female race.
Right.
But I mean, I guess sort of counter, I do think that we are in a moment of high profile women in comedy. And I do think that even in the realm of men, a comic like Louis C.K. would be basically unthinkable like 20 years ago. But I guess I would counter that I sort of think that comedy should be hostile to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that it was. Like, I wish that Sam Morril would apply that gimlet eye of his at men for real.
Right, right. That's why you thought that joke was funny. Because
yeah.
even Quvenzhané Wallace should not be exempt from comedy scrutiny. Right?
Well, because that joke
was a reference.
Right, that tweet wasn't about her. That tweet literally, the only role she played in that was being the cutest, most adorable possible subject
right,
for an outrageous Anne yes. Hathaway-esque thing to tweet.
Right.
And that was it. And that was why it was funny. And that was why that one worked for me, was because that had a very specific point and also like made me laugh out loud.
Wait,
when I first read it.
What was its specific point?
The specific point was to, in my mind, I read it as, these are the kinds of things that we say about celebrities on Twitter without even thinking about it
oh,
with the
I
Oscars.
See. I got it.
Because
yeah.
we think we understand something about them. And so we will be willing to say something this absurd and horrible just because we want to be part of the conversation.
Got it. I totally missed that. I thought the joke was that, you know, she is the most adorable. Like, everyone's talking about how totally adorable it is. So
but in real life, she's actually
opposite.
A cunt.
No, just like, let's just say the opposite. You know, just
right.
To,
no,
just,
I think, no,
part
I mean,
of
that
would. Yeah,
yeah, sort of. But that's not that funny. I mean, that's like a three. But like in my head, at least, the joke's like a seven.
Right. Okay. Got it. All right.
It's hard on Twitter. There's not enough context, you know?
I'm like Borat. It's like, explain the American joke to me now. All right.
That was a pretty good American joke, Hannah.
Oh, yep. Boy. All right. Let's move on.
A great Kazakh accent.
We do that not joke in my household and I.
Oh, my God.
Okay, let's move on to our second topic, which is the rehabilitation of the American political cad. But before we do that, I want to thank our loyal sponsor, which is Audible.com. Audible offers over 100,000 audiobooks, as well as almost any form of enlightened chatter, podcasts, books, anything you want, available on the internet, and you can listen to them on any device, including the one you are using to listen to us right now. And for XX listeners who aren't already Audible members, you get a free audiobook of your choice when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at the URL audiblepodcast.com/XX, not XX, but XX. And that includes a free subscription to either the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal Daily Audio Digest. So I'm going to – my recommendation this week, and all of my recommendations are going to be to the theme of – you know, for anyone out there who still doesn't think women are funny, women are damn funny. And I actually collected a bunch of female comedian books, but then I decided that actually you should just listen to Nora Ephron, because she reads all of her books on Audible. And the ones that she doesn't read, she reads I Remember Nothing and Other Reflections and I Feel Bad About My Neck. And the ones that she doesn't read are read by Meryl Streep. So all of those are totally worth listening to. Okay. What would Nora Ephron have to say about Anthony Weiner and Mark Sanford? That I would like to read.
That just made me sadder than anything anyone's ever said about Nora Ephron being dead.
If only she were here to talk about those dweebs. Mark Sanford, he easily won his race for Congress in South Carolina barely 3 years after a scandal involving a mistress in Argentina and a giant lie about the Appalachian Trail, right? Now, Anthony Weiner, who resigned a little over a year ago after he tweeted a picture of his wiener, to some young
his
groupies.
Package. His
American
package.
Joke.
American joke. His package is seriously considering running for mayor. Both of them say they're sorry, and apparently people believe them. Do we? So we started this conversation, and I had to confess that I totally bought that Anthony Weiner cover story in the New York Times magazine.
You bought it?
Yes, I did. I didn't purchase it. I mean, I was like,
right.
Yeah.
What did you like? Why?
Oh my God, Dan is like never. Sometimes somebody looks at you, and they're like, and you're like, this person is never going to think of me the same way again, just by the composure of their face as they're looking at you.
It's acting. You're fine. Why? So why did you? What about it made you believe in his sincerity?
I don't know that I believed in his sincerity because I don't actually believe in anybody's sincerity. It's just like, politicians, and particularly a politician like Anthony Weiner, doesn't believe in anything very much. He's like just a young sort of ambitious machine. That's my view of Anthony Weiner. So I think what happens is that he decides sort of which box to put himself in at any given moment, and that makes him a better or worse person, right? So at the time, he was living in the kind of meteoric rise. I can do whatever I want. I can get away with whatever I want. I mean, he's totally externally driven, right? So he was living in that box. And now he's living in the box, which is, I think, this is my theory, why we forgive all men these days. He was living in the kind of new 21st century enlightened man box. Like, I take care of my baby. I support my wife in her career. I have pictures of me sitting by the baby's crib. It's like he's the modern man now. And we all look at that and think, okay, he's adopted another persona, which is like an acceptable persona.
That is not how I looked at that story.
That is not the vibe I got. That's an amazingly cynical way to read. I mean, not untrue necessarily. Mm-hmm. But Noreen, tell us how you read that story.
I mean, I'm with Hannah on the he's a creature of politics part. I guess I am just like more grossed out by how clearly that was on display.
What do you mean? That he like it was so obviously posed and like
– It was obviously posed. I mean, I was actually a little saddened by how much his wife seemed to be in on it, right? Like they have a partnership that I can't understand. It's just that's their marriage. You can never understand someone else's marriage. But, when the scandal broke, she was pushing him to stay in the job. She was, clearly – she signed on for a certain amount of embarrassment to herself to sort of get him back in the spotlight. But that's – I mean, that's not about him. That's about her. But what sort of killed me was the stuff at the end where he said, I just needed affirmation from outside, which is sort of honest, right? Like that is what politicians need. But it didn't make me sympathetic to him. He still clearly needs it,
Right.
Right. He needs it so much that he managed to get himself a New York Times Magazine cover story about how he might be ready for office again.
And to me, the most devastating thing in the whole article was his brother calling him a prick.
But not as much of a prick as he used to be, right? Wasn't the line like, he used to come off really douchey, but he's not so douchey now.
My theory of like human temperament is that, if you're born, if you happen to be born a prick, which he was, like you can't change that 100%. You just can't. I mean, you can change your personhood like 15%. Like you can move to slightly less douchiness, very rare, like Chuck Colson, maybe like of the Nixon era, right? Like he then dedicated his whole life to like prison ministry. So like somebody like that, unless you're really going to give it your all like that and kind of redeem your prickiness in a kind of huge, extravagant way, which almost nobody does and certainly nobody in American politics does, you're kind of going to hope for slightly low.
So the most we can ask is that Anthony Weiner directs his prickishness in an appropriate direction.
No, that he's slightly less prickish. Like, it wasn't merely that he took those photographs. Did you not, Noreen, the reporter seemed to buy into their relationship as a genuine kind of banter back and forth relationship. Like, they had a real relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's what I mean by you can't, like, look into someone's relationship. I did find it fascinating that her first instinct about him was to be like, he's such a jerk. And she sort of put him off for 5 or 10 years or however long it was.
Right. Right. Well, wouldn't you put that guy off for 5 or 10? He's my congressman, by the way. He's the Queen's congressman.
So do you think he's a good congressman or do you think he just gets on TV a lot?
Well, look, my mom's like a, older Jewish lady Israel. Like, he's good for the people of Queens, sure. Like, he's a schmoozer and he's, yeah, He's not. I often think about him in relationship to Elliot Spitzer, because Elliot Spitzer has none of that new man in him and is never going to be able to. It's just in the nature of Elliot Spitzer. But Elliot Spitzer actually believes in things. Like, in some ways, it's kind of a shame that of all of them, Elliot Spitzer is never going to be able to come back in the way that these guys came back into politics, because he had like agendas and missions and things that he believed in and fought for.
And he got shit done.
And he got shit done, and like he, you know, he's the one who, like, just on paper, sort of should be handed a job again because he'll do good things with it. Like, what's Wiener going to do? He's going to do for Wiener, like, in Huma. I mean, they'll, you know, he's that's all he's ever going to do. So
I think that's how people feel about Sanford. I mean, Sanford's politics are not my politics, but I think maybe that is what is perhaps different about him, is people feel like he has a moral core and something that he's, you know, really sort of going back to office for. I mean, I also think what's different between Sanford and Wiener is that I can understand having an affair with someone you're in love with. Like, that is within, you know, that's within a universe of emotions that I understand. But, like, just tweeting pictures of your genitals to randos on the internet is like, I don't know. I would be more upset if my husband did that.
Right, because it's completely incomprehensible. And yeah. I mean, that sort of is why I can – yes, I also buy Sanford's rehabilitation more than Wiener's, because Sanford, though I haven't done it, I can totally understand falling in love with someone who's not your wife. But yes –
You guys are such prudes.
But when you refer – but here's the thing, Hannah. When you refer to Wiener, you called him a young, ambitious machine, right?
Right.
But so doesn't the fact that someone that ambitious did something that idiotic suggest that there's like a bug in the machine? Like there's something wrong in its programming?
I totally understand.
Right. So that is the kind of thing that I feel like is going to make voters go – like, it's one thing to say is the person representing me the person who might fall in love with someone and make a misjudgment? Sure, that's normal. Slash, is the person representing me someone who for no reason at all would just take a picture of his junk and tweet it at someone, which is insane.
No, okay.
Why would you vote for that person?
Because there's a slightly different calculation in my head. It's not that Sanford – you guys – come on. It's not like he fell in love with another woman. That's not the problem with Mark Sanford. It's like he's a deep Christian conservative, right? He's a family values conservative. And he like fucking lied and told people that he was on the Appalachian Trail or whatever. I mean, that's his sin. His sin is not that he fell in love with another woman who was not his wife. And he, you know, and the thing that I can't get my head around with Sanford is the American question, not so much the characterological question. It's like a different set of questions with Sanford. What is up with these southern states who vote uber conservative, and then they have these like holes of forgiveness, which I just can't understand.
Because every human being, whether they vote conservative or liberal, whether they're religious or not religious, has needed to be forgiven for something in their lives.
So you took a picture of your junk. Do different people have different sins? Like, in a way, like, who did worse on their wife? Like, who betrayed their marriage vows more, Sanford or Wiener? Like, Sanford, he left his wife for some woman he was having an affair with in Argentina. Like, okay, I'm not saying who would you want to be
Hold on. You're a Puritan, and America is an evangelical Christian nation, right? So there is a tradition within evangelical Christianity of sort of testifying to your sins. And Sanford got up and he did that. He wept at this conference and he talked about all of the things that he'd done wrong, but also his great love. And I think that actually, you know, we're saying that, oh, Americans be – John Dickerson wrote a great column saying Americans become French. We don't care what politicians do in their private lives, but we do care. We're fascinated by it, just like we're fascinated by sin of all kinds. But you know, if you buy that America is a Judeo-Christian nation, like, forgiveness is fully baked into the Christian religion.
Okay, but like, what if it had been a man? I mean, honestly, I was reading Leviticus the other day. Like, right up there with the gay sex is the cheating on your wife, is the, you know, they're all in the same little section, right? Of the Bible. And so why is one sort of horrible and totally unforgivable? If that woman in Argentina had been a man, like, he'd be screwed no matter how many times he cried up on that press conference, right?
Well, we're not quite French yet, but
I'd like to have someone have a big cheerful press conference in which they admit that they wore mixed fabrics.
Exactly. Or they touched their wife while she was menstruating. Okay, well, let's move on to our third topic. The most recent cover story of the New Republic posits loneliness as a public health crisis and an epidemic. Emotional isolation, argues author Judith Shulevitz, brings this high risk factor for mortality is smoking, and also it's remarkably common. 30% of Americans report feeling not close to anyone, and among those 45 and older, the numbers are even higher. In the story, one is the deadliest number. Judith explains the biology of loneliness and who it can afflict. We are talking to Judith today. Where are we talking to you from? You're in New York now?
I'm in New York, yes.
Excellent.
In a lonely but very not lonely place.
Right. Lonely but not lonely place. It's good that you said it that way, because my very first question to you is to define the terms, because lonely is one of those words we use casually, like depressed, you know, I'm really lonely, I'm alone. How is it different from being alone or being in solitude?
So the psychologists define it differently. There's being alone, and that's, you know, not being around people. You can go off on some wilderness trek for weeks on end and you're alone. But as long as you don't experience it as a sort of painful feeling inside yourself, that's not loneliness. Loneliness is the feeling of being cut off from others, of lacking intimacy. You can be lonely in a crowd. Famously, you can be lonely in New York City. You can be lonely in a marriage. There's maybe nothing lonelier than being in a bad marriage. So it's not about the physical proximity of people. It's about how you experience yourself in relation to them.
Yeah, one thing that brought the definition home for me was these college experiments that you described. I don't know how sort of deep and profound they were, but they did seem to get at this definition very well, that your loneliness in college, because that's a time when you're sort of broken off from your immediate ties, has less to do with how many friends you have and more to do with how many intimates you have. Did I understand that correctly? Can
Yes.
you describe those studies a little?
I mean, what's interesting about I am not convinced that the psychologist who undertook them was doing it because college is such a crucial moment in your lives, maybe. But, you know, psychologists are always testing undergraduates because they're there.
Right.
But as it turns out, as he points out, John Cacioppo is the leading scholar of loneliness, or the leading psychologist on the subject. And as he points out in his book, college is a time when you leave home, you leave a secure environment, you leave all your friends, and you have to go to a completely new environment, you have to make a completely new set of friends. And most people, of course, are lonely for a while, and then they enter a social group, and they're fine. Some people will fail at that test and will be lonely throughout the whole 4 years of college. So he tested these undergraduates, and what he discovered was that the signs, the biological signs of loneliness that he was looking for, were present in the people who also reported in their verbal reports not having friends that they trusted, that they could rely on, that they felt really close to. It correlated not at all with how many friends they had, right? If you have if you're part of a wide circle, but you don't really feel close to anyone in that circle, then you meet the definition of loneliness. And it didn't even correlate to how much time you spent hanging around with people. You could, you know, spend all your time in this group, you know, but not feel close to any of them and be lonely.
The super heartbreaking part of the piece I found was, you know, that the situation you're describing could happen to any of us at any given moment for one reason or another. You know, it happened to me when I was living overseas, I would say, for a long period of time. Like, you can fall into a situation where for circumstantial reasons you don't have any intimates around or who you can easily access. But then there's another category of people who are prone to loneliness for one reason or another. Can you talk about that category of people?
Right. So there's the question of, is lonely heritable? Is loneliness, heritable? And there are some studies that show that, in fact, it is heritable. There might be sort of social aptitudes that you can inherit that predispose you toward loneliness or lack of aptitudes, perhaps. But only, you know, psychologists and sociologists like to put numbers on things. So they've come up with this number, 48%, and they did this through twin studies, and I won't go into the details. But that means that still 52% is circumstantial and has to do with
48% of what? It's like 48% of the, you know, propensity to loneliness is heritable? Is that what they mean?
So in other words, these statistics are always population-wide, right?
Uh-huh.
So, you know, 48% of the loneliness that you see in a population, you can sort of chalk up to heritability. So they come from lonely families, there's probably some genetic predisposition to having a social attitude that is lonelier than somebody who's very gregarious. You know, when you have children, as you know, you just they come out of the womb and they're this way or that way, and there is a genetic component to what their personalities are like, right?
So now you didn't get into this, but one thing I wondered a lot about, especially when you got into the heritability questions, was how this overlays with the autism spectrum. Is that something anybody writes about, that people who are on the spectrum have a greater propensity to loneliness, or they're sort of protected from it for some reason? It seemed like an obvious connection.
You know, there are people who write about everything, Hannah. It is unbelievable how much work is being done, especially on autism, because there's a lot of money out there for it. And I don't know the literature as well as I might, so I'm not going to speculate too much, but I would say that when you are unable to pick up on social cues, that is a pretty sure sign that you're probably going to be lonely.
Uh-huh.
There's also work being done on inflammation and autism, and there's some thinking that it actually, the conditions that cause inflammation also are related to the conditions that cause autism. So there might even be a biological link here. But I would say that it's unclear to me if you have severe autism. I don't know enough about autism to know how lonely you feel. But I would say probably if you have Asperger's, if you're on the spectrum at that level, you probably are pretty lonely because, you know, you just can't connect.
Right, right. So now the health connections, how strong are they? Like how convinced? I mean, you laid them out kind of. You laid out the health factors of being lonely.
Right. I laid out what can happen to you. I mean, there's just a huge body of evidence out there. It's all correlation. And it's the core, it's in other words, they see links between how lonely people report they are and how sick they are and how fast they get sick and how they seem to be likely to die a lot sooner than people who don't report loneliness. What actually, it was hard to get this specific about it in the piece, but what's actually new here is that people are now understanding not just that there's this correlation, it seems to happen at the same time, but they're seeing how biologically it gets processed through the body. They can now see how it works genetically, immunologically, endocrinologically, which means how having to do with hormones. So now there's just this new science that allows you to look into the bodily processes in a way that wasn't possible before, and they're actually seeing how it works. And so they're actually able to show that when you are lonely, when you perceive loneliness, right, when you perceive yourself as lonely, your body reacts as if it were in fight or flight mode, which means a lot of adrenaline pumps through your body. Your body experiences a kind of traumatic stress, which all the work on stress that's been done the last 20 years shows that it has really quite devastating effects on the body. And it can really throw your immune system particularly out of whack. So part of your immune system becomes very sort of overactive, your tissues become inflamed, and you basically act as if you're about to be attacked by a tiger, basically.
Right.
And you're sort of in this whole defensive crouch. Your body goes into a defensive crouch, and your tissues are inflamed because all the white blood cells are rushing into it, so that they can heal quickly after the tiger sinks his teeth into you, right?
And the tiger here
that,
is just...
All that actually takes resources away from the part of your immune system that fights off viruses and colds. So that means you're much more susceptible to a whole range of disorders, and your body sort of could fight off wounds. But if your body stays in this state of inflammation for a really long period of time, it has terrible effects on your heart. It predisposes you to diabetes. I mean, there's all kinds of things that get thrown out of whack. So that's the basic mechanism, is your body going into this fight or flight mode and staying there because you're really lonely for a really long period of time.
And Judith, how severe does that loneliness have to be for there to be physical effects? Like within, you know, for an average person who has, you know, a few, let's say like one or two bouts of loneliness in their life or just is occasionally lonely, you know, is there going to be a marked effect there?
No. We're talking lifelong loneliness, or we're talking, you know, chronic loneliness in old age over a period of decades, you know.
What I thought was amazing about the piece, one of the things that was amazing in this piece, Judith, was this notion that these biological changes that happen to your body when you're experiencing loneliness can be remedied to some extent just by the introduction of partnership or friendship or companionship, or by aiding that loneliness, you actually physically change the body back to something approaching its previous state.
Well, Dan, I mean, that is why this. So I've actually written a series of pieces that all have one common theme in the New Republic, which is the malleability of the body through by way of social experiences and emotional experiences. That is what I am blown away by. And in a way, it's why I became a science writer and I made this shift in my life, is because I'm so fascinated by all this new science about how the body can be ravaged by social experiences and how the body can heal itself through social experiences. And what's cool about the loneliness piece is we can be, it literally proves that we can be, I mean, not my piece, but the science here, literally proves that we can be healed by love. You take a Romanian orphan, you know, who is, in fact, irremediably damaged by being in this orphanage, at least if he or she has been in the orphanage for more than 2 years. But you can actually undo a fair amount of the damage just through steady, reliable, deep love. It's and you can actually see the changes. You can see the remediation in the brain, in the cognitive functioning, in the body. It's incredible how malleable we are.
You know, it's you could read this story and then take away some public policy prescriptions kind of thing. But the thing that stuck with me is this thing that you're the original psychologist you quote. Is it what's her last name? Frieda Fromm Reichman, right? That actually we are kind of we're scared of lonely people. We shun lonely people. We sort of, you know, we increase their social isolation because we're afraid it's going to rub off on us in some way. And so, the prescription one should take away is to, you know, look out for lonely people, right? That you should not fear that situation.
That's right. I mean, so one of the psychologists I talk about in the piece did tests which shows that we actually process rejection, which is a part of loneliness, I think, as if it were physical, in the same part of the brain that processes a blow, a physical mm-hmm. blow, physical mm-hmm. pain. And we don't, and I asked her, well, yeah, but I know the difference between having someone say a cutting, mean thing to me and being hit in the face. I mean, I do know that difference. She said, yeah, there's various things that go on in the brain that allow you to recognize the difference, but part of the brain is processing it in the same way. And she said, you know, one of the implications of that is we would never, in a school, you know, we would never let a child get away with hitting another child. I mean, it happens, but we would punish the hitting child. But we think nothing of letting groups of people chronically exclude, you know, some vulnerable person. And maybe now that we know that social pain is as hard on the body as, and the psyche, of course, as physical pain, maybe we should do something about that in our schools, in our institutions, in the way we treat people.
All right, well, let's end on that. Thank you so much, Judith, for joining us today.
Thank you, Hannah.
Okay, let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen, why don't you go first?
I stumbled across an article. I'm not even sure how I stumbled across this. I think from Byline or something like that, from 10 years ago in Texas Monthly by Pamela Koloff, who's just a wonderful writer who now does a lot of crime writing. But she wrote this article called Lipstick, and it's just a journey to the Neiman Marcus in Dallas to buy makeup. And that sounds like a very slight topic, and it is, but it's just a really funny, smart, incisive article. That's just a lot of fun.
That's great. I'm a big fan of hers, but I don't know that one, so I'm going to go back and look it up.
It was not of a piece with what I know her writing for now, and that's part of the reason I found it so delightful.
Good. Okay, I have actually a couple of recommendations all on the funny women vein. One is for Veep watchers, if you haven't yet, the latest Veep, which is called Helsinki, has just the most seriously hilarious scene between Veep and the Finnish prime minister, who's played by Sally Phillips, who was in Bridget Jones, I believe. But anyway, it's just like this 6 minutes of them interacting in this official event, which is so unbelievably funny. And the second thing is that I've been reading a lot of The Reductress, which is this Onion for women. And they particularly had an article apt to what we were discussing called The Creator of Rape in America documentary talks about hair care. For those of you who don't know The Reductress, it's, you know, pitched as an Onion for women. And it has many, many hilarious stories every day. So
finally, an Onion for women.
All right, Dan, what do you got?
I this week read a very funny novel by a woman I went to college with, actually, named Mer Lafferty, who has self-published many excellent science fiction and fantasy books. But this is her first book for a New York publisher, and it's called The Shambling Guide to New York City. And it is about a young, heartbroken travel writer who moves to New York City and gets hired as the managing editor of a new series of travel guides for magical creatures visiting the city. So she works with several zombies and a water spirit and a goddess of death and a couple of other characters, and she gets embroiled in a big mystery in New York City as it becomes the target of an occultist. It's very funny.
And this is like Aaron Sorkin does Game of Thrones.
It sort of is. It's very funny and charming and crazy, and I really like the character in the middle of it who's like just a very smart woman at sea in her life who figures shit out.
Sounds great. Well, thank you all for listening today. Thank you to Chris Wade for engineering this podcast. Thank you to Andy Bowers, who's the executive producer of all the Slate podcasts. As always, please join us on our Facebook page. Leave us comments, questions, and tell us what you want to talk about next time. For Dan and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.